we are in the mood of a chat.
You see, my daughter has been named after her, and yes, she didn't even know, know it. No, 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 I didn't.
I do.
Yeah, no, I know
and
you know it,
do you know
it,
what the name means, eh? Yeah. The name is very strong meaning.
Say it again.
It means protector of humanity.
Oh, I have to tell
defender
her
defender of humanity.
Defender, I have to tell her. And one day she has to meet you.
Ah, yes. Yes. She can come and stay with me for some time.
My daughter's name is Alessandra, but I didn't know Alessandra at the time. But in a way, after I met Alessandra, I said, actually, I like the fact that that you share the name of my daughter, because I wish I named her after you. She's somebody who I would love my daughter to emulate, although I'm not sure I would want my Alessandra in all the war zones that this Alessandra has spent time in. I think I would worry too much.
What was going through my mind is, I'm dying. If we can't make it through the gate again, we're gonna die here. We're gonna die in a UNHCR car, and we're gonna die in the full functions of my duty. And I was holding the hand of the person next to me. The driver saved our life.
Alessandra Morelli's life has taken her from a convent to the front lines. She's seen it all, and she's a force of nature. One of the most positive people I know. Where does that drive come from? I'm Melissa Fleming, and this is Awake at Night. So, hello, Alessandra. Thank you so much for coming into the studio during your short time here in Geneva. It's great to see you.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much for allowing me to share.
Yeah, I know
my
you just
story.
Came here from your current posting in Niger, but I want to first ask you, at one stage almost lost your life working on behalf of refugees, the displaced people in Somalia, in Mogadishu. It was February, it was 2014. What happened?
Yes, well, Mogadishu, 2014, just a day before Valentine's Day. It's very difficult to forget. That morning, I decided to go and supervise the finalized security work in the compound, in the UN compound, where the UNHCR had an office and its accommodation.
And just to picture what these compounds look like, they're
fortresses in the middle of a city, Mogadishu being at very high risk. So after touring around and being briefed, I was satisfied with the works. I was returning, and at a certain moment, there was this enormous.
You were in a car. Just
I was
describe,
in a.
You were in
yes,
a car,
I was in a car.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a car in a UNHCR vehicle, in a UNHCR armored vehicle. They call it the B6, which is the very armored vehicle, and I was escorted by 22 armed men. So I was in the car, I was reading, I was preparing my intervention with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, I remember, and at a certain moment, an incredible bang, and the car rocked right and left, like a ball of fire in the air. The car stopped. Smoke started coming into the car, and with my colleagues, because we were four, I said, are you all alive? Are we all alive? And we had this, we were incredible readiness, if you want, to position ourselves into the brace position when you go brace, and to realize, to touch ourselves if we had all our pieces on the right, in the right place.
You really were touching yourself to see
everywhere,
if you had your
everywhere,
body
everywhere, everywhere one can touch, I tell you the truth. And to check if we had blood and checking on each other. But then this smoke started to come in the car, and the car could not move. So the guards started shooting all around us to ensure that nobody would come close to the car. And we were asking for help. We were not far away from the entrance to the compound, and people saw this ball of fire, which was the suicide car. The suicide car hit the car, went on our car. And
so the suicide car was actually
driving against us, yes,
in order to blow your car up.
Absolutely,
they
do it, but the armored vehicle did its job. The armored vehicle really crunched itself on us almost. Resisted, but the problem was that we could not start. So we were there for a couple of minutes, really. And in the UN compound, they heard this noise and they said, oh my God, whoever is there is dead. Because this ball of fire, a big sound, and then in a few seconds, but it's UNHCR, it's UNHCR, and then even more, but it's the rep, it's Alessandra. So you went from it's UNHCR, it's the rep, it's Alessandra, it's Ali. It's Ali in that car, no? So it was incredible how they
recounted this to you afterwards.
Yes, so from the very general to the person that was living in the compound, I was living in Mogadishu. Mm. To
what were you thinking at the moment when that ball of fire surrounded you?
I said to myself, oh my God, this is now happening to me. You always read, you prepared yourself, but, you know, living in Mogadishu and working in Mogadishu like it was in Afghanistan, like in every high-risk environment, you always think it will never happen to you, but whenever there is a sound and you operate in these environments, you're already associated to an attack. So, you know, in that sense, the sense of vigilance and readiness is always there.
So when you knew it was happening to you, what was going through your mind?
What was going through my mind is I'm dying. If we can't make it through the gate again, we're gonna die here. We're gonna die in a UNHCR car, and we're gonna die in the full functions of my duty. And I was holding the hand of the person next to me. The driver saved our life.
How did the driver save your life?
Save my life by trying to restart that car. He remained cold, focused. And that car started after a couple of minutes, full of smoke, as I said, inside. And it moved at the chitty chitty bang bang, you know, like this. And we arrived in the compound, and there we had the care of everybody. My reaction was, I could not, the only piece of the suicide bomber I saw was a part of his arm. The rest was totally blown. I looked at that arm and I entered into communication with that arm. I had to. And my answer was, my question was, why did you do this? You know, why did you do this? And what hurted me most, because of course I went into therapy, through this system called the EMDR, which is the eye movement. It's a tactic that helps you rehabilitate, like in a film, like I'm doing here with you today. But today I'm able to talk about it. Before I was not. So the therapy helped me re-establish the trauma and re-elaborate it and to put it back into that right dimension that today is a memory that I am able to share and not something that is victimizing me or blocking me.
Yeah.
So it's not, as I say, it's a train that is passing by me and not a train that is passing inside me.
It took several days before you recognized in yourself
it took
that you
several
actually
days.
Needed help.
Yes, mm-hmm. We did not want to leave immediately. Well, let me tell you that 7 people died. The bypassers died. And so when I elaborated the situation, there are 2 moments where I could not proceed anymore. One is I left that compound. Somebody must have betrayed me. Somebody must have informed somebody that in that car, for that moment, there was a high profile. I'm not a high profile person, but in that moment, in that car, there was something more juicy, if you want. Let's put it that way. That hurted me. The sense of betrayal hurted me. So I had to elaborate that. And then the moving ahead is the fact that UNHCR brings life. That day, UNHCR car brought death. because of me passing, because of the UNHCR car passing, seven Somalis died. And these seven Somalis were just being deported from Saudi Arabia. They were, because I was close to the airport when it happened. So seven Somalis deported from Saudi Arabia, just standing in the street, not knowing where to go.
They had been migrant workers in Saudi Arabia. Yes. And they had just been deported back to Mogadishu.
Yes.
And were
bystanders. Yes. Next to the little coffee shops and tea shops, wondering what next in my life, no? So I did not want to leave Mogadishu immediately for several reasons. One, because I react by reconciling with the environment. If I left, I would have probably never come back. And two, the sense of responsibility. So I was the victim, but at the same time, I was the incident manager. At the same time. So I had to manage the anxiety of others. Oh my God, the rep has been hit. She's going to go now. What will happen with us? This is how it is, you know, in the high-risk environments. Working in high-risk...
A lot of the colleagues are national staff,
yes,
right?
Yes. Working in high-risk environments, the manager becomes a bit everything for the staff. Eh? It's not just the leader.
So who were you to them?
Bye. We were living together, eating together, fighting for challenges and overcoming challenges together 24 hours a day, even with the national staff. I think we were all, not only me for them, but we were a core. It was a very tight family. So I said, how am I going to manage this? We will reconcile. I took all the affection of the people, said, let me get all the affection of the people in the UN compound. It was a moment where everybody would come and hug you. I said, let's take this, take all of this energy. But then I was sitting several hours a day in front of the car to reconcile. And after I realized I needed to go because a colleague threw a Coca-Cola can. And the can hit the ground and made a noise, and I jumped. And that I said, no, now it's time to go. But it was the right time to go because I reconciled somehow. I went, I stayed three weeks at home doing this elaboration.
So you went back to Italy.
For physiotherapy also because my back was hit and my back still suffers today. My vertebrae collapsed.
It was the impact of the explosion.
Of course. So both the passenger sitting in the front and myself were the ones hit. Him more than me, and he bears a little bit. He bears the consequences today.
Initially, this was to get medical treatment, physical medical treatment.
Physiotherapy.
But then you realized that you needed help for PTSD.
Absolutely, to avoid entering into PTSD.
Okay. So, and this was your own decision.
Yes.
You self-diagnosed yourself that you had what's called post-traumatic stress syndrome. What were the symptoms that you started feeling?
The symptoms was that every noise would make me jump. So when you start associating a noise, and that noise triggers in you this sensation of fear, of freeziness when you freeze, or anxiety. Then that noise is just not a noise. That you have to understand why that noise is bothering you. So, well, this is another thing. It's 26 years I'm now with UNHCR, and most of my career I developed it in war zones. So you do develop a self-capacity to, you become a bit of a psychologist as well. Because I've grown in leadership line, of course I read and of course I did some courses and of course I asked for help on how to manage a team in a high-risk environment. This I have to say with all honesty, I have learned.
I think a number of colleagues that I've met, I think, maybe didn't reach out for the help they needed.
No.
They look around them and say,
humble.
Others are suffering more. What happened to me is nothing compared. And then they don't seek the help. And what made you decide that you
because
really needed
the
help?
Responsibility of my role as a leader. Mm-hmm. I had to put the oxygen mask on before putting it to others. If I wanted to come back to Mogadishu, I had to be.
And this whole time you were thinking, I'm doing this because I want to go back to
Mogadishu. But I didn't finish my cell, no?
Your cell, you have to explain that.
My length of stay? I'm joking, no. Yes, to return to Mogadishu because my place was still there.
Alessandra did go back to Somalia. Just a few months later, she took a colleague back to the spot where the attack happened.
And right here, isn't it? Right here?
Yes.
Right here. Big bang. We were hit. Right here. And it's 35 meters to the airport gate. So the car was stopped, was blocked, because it's all automatic. It couldn't re-engage anymore. And the car was full of smoke because, of course, the blast did not break the car, but created some openings.
I think our listeners might be surprised that actually after you were targeted for a terrorist attack.
Well, of course, I did not go back on my own. I was basically through consultations with the psychologist.
Of course.
And of course, it was a consensus reaching. I was ready to go back. And, that's
you think
what
it
I
helped
say.
You in some way to go back to
it did, where it did, the it did. It did. Absolutely,
happened.
It did. It's like when you say, at least in Italian, when you fall off the horse, you get on that horse again. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you risk not to go. And since my life is dedicated to the safeguard of human dignity, I mean, it's like an ER doctor, you know, then if you don't go back to that, then you change. I say, just to tease a little bit, to bring a bit of also teasing on this, from post-traumatic stress to post-traumatic strength, you can go into that.
How?
By being humble enough to go through this elaboration and this pause and try and have seek help to reassess a little bit the image of what happened and put it in that right position and
Did you keep anything from that day?
I
Can
did.
You describe what it was?
I have a picture of the site. And you can see how that suicide car is now like paper mash, the car. I can show you the picture. What I have with me is a piece of the armored iron and pieces of the window. It's in a small little bag there.
It's in a little bag?
I put it in a little bag, yeah. I had a little, it was, no, more than that, it's a little image of the Virgin Mary that my mom gave me, knowing that that I was working in Somalia. And I just brought it with me and didn't know that I was going to go through that. You see, every time I left my compound, and colleagues that have been working or are working in Somalia can understand, every time I had to leave that compound with doing the same gestures every day, take my flat jacket and put it on. And every time you put it on, it's because you're going out there. And so it's a moment of reflection. You say, I'm going. And that day, I remember very well, I had that image within my bag. And I always have a picture of what symbolizes my dad on my wall. And my dad is symbolized by an airplane taking off. So
he was an executive at Alitalia, right? The Italian
that
national
plane,
airline.
It's that plane that carries his name. So for me, has a certain symbolism and a certain strength. So that takeoff, you know, always above the clouds and go above the clouds and, you know, don't stay into the nitty gritty. Just go above the clouds and you see things from a different perspective and easier to solve. So I just put my hand on it. I said, okay, I'm out of here. God knows if those gestures, you know, you want to bring a little bit of magic around that, right?
You felt that they were protecting you in some way.
Somehow I always do. I always do.
But 10 months after her return to Mogadishu, something terrible happened. On Christmas Day 2014, during a celebration lunch, a group of suicide bombers attacked their compound. That day, Alessandra was in charge. She and her team were under siege for 21 hours.
Well, indeed, it was like, you know, the test if really I was ready to come back or not, no? That period, I was even the officer in charge for security. I was the DO, the third in line.
So all the
line,
senior officials, you were the third in line, and you were in charge of the
third
UN
in line. I was in charge
Somalia.
Of the UN in Somalia in that moment. Yeah. Can you imagine? And say, it's Christmas, you know, it's going to be cool. Well, 1320, I still remember Christmas lunch. We hear this noises, this shooting around us. I was moving with my plate to drop it at the kitchen, and the alarm goes off, and I am literally taken by this big Fijian man and brought into the command and control room, the place where I would have to manage that the crisis, the situation. So 21 hours under siege with colleagues in bunkers who slept even in bunkers, 21 hours with seven suicide bombers in the UN compound. That is amazing.
So how did you deal with this situation?
I dealt how I know how to deal. I mean, when in difficult situations, although I am known as very outgoing and joking and smiling, in crisis, I am boom. I am cold, I am centered, and it's like there is an instinct on what to do next. So I had advisors around me, of course. Eh? I'm not alone. And I have
to say,
where
were the armed men in relation to you?
Ah, they were not far away. Their plan was to blow up the containers where we had the UN had its gas and its fuel, but they did not succeed.
Tragically, three African Union peacekeepers and a civilian contractor were killed before the siege ended. The UN staff were all safe. You spent most of your life at UNHCR in war zones. Do you have a faith that has helped you get through these really difficult times, things that you see? Is there anything that keeps you going?
Yeah, I believe that there is somebody that is the father and the mother together, father and mother of us. I just can't believe that beauty like we are just came like this. There must be a design behind, no? So yes, I believe in that value, in that I'm not somebody who goes to church every Sunday, but I feel that naturally these values of solidarity and respect are very strong, because they come probably they were. They come. I discovered them within myself, and then they are a product, and they are, I think, generated by the fantastic life I lived throughout my childhood until now in different locations. That's why I say my journey in the mist. I was conceived in India in 1960, and since that day, I have never stopped moving. One part because of life of my dad's work, and then with the UNHCR.
You did stop for a short period of time, and you decided at what stage? You had a boyfriend, but you decided to leave him and to become a nun.
Yes, this is true.
How old were you? And
I was actually going to get married even, yes. I throw everything there out of the window, as they say. And I a Franciscan, yes, a Franciscan becoming. I did not become 100. I was on my way too, but I lived certainly a life of meditation and silence. And I think that if I'm able to handle situations today in UNHCR,
take your time.
It's because I had the opportunity to reflect on life and who I am for six years in a monastery, yes.
You spent 6 years in
a
monastery. I spent
6 years in a monastery. I left the monastery and I joined UNHCR in 1992, like this.
What made you decide to become a nun, to join a monastery?
Exactly. It's this strong drive. Because I've been in different, different dresses, different shirts, if you want, or different colors. But the leitmotif is always the same in different dimensions. And it's this, very, very, very clear, very clear. The safeguard of human dignity. I think from a life always as a pilgrim, always itinerant, always in movement, I needed probably a few years where I stood still. And that's where I think I really understood who I am. You never understand who you are, but at least your values and what is guiding you, what are your anchors. But then this is a bit of a characteristic of me. I after a while, I feel that I need another lay, another step, and another step, and another step. It's like it becomes too small.
And when it became too small, decided to leave.
I move.
Tell me the story about how you transitioned into UNHCR.
Well, then I left the convent, I left the monastery, and of course I returned home, and my parents were not really happy, not because I left the convent. Actually, they were very happy I left the convent. They were really not in agreement. They said, wow, how did this happen? I mean, I don't come from a particularly religious family. And my father said, fine, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I'll find something to do. Don't count on me, I said. And then I was watching TV, and this 1992, 1991, the start of the former Yugoslavia war, and I said, yeah, that's where I'm going. So I went to look at this UN, UNHCR, I couldn't find it, the UN, and I end up in the office in Italy. And I said, hi, I'm looking for a job. And they say, well, that's not really how we recruit. So this person gave me the form every UNHCR or UN candidate fills to support his or her CV. And they were kind enough also to advise me to show my face, to go to Geneva and show my face. You never know. So I asked my father, who was working for the Italian Airlines, saying, can you help me with the ticket? And where are you going to go? What are you going to go and do in Geneva? Well, there is this organization. I said, you will never get it. I mean, how can somebody go alone to the UN? I enter the HR on my own, asking. People were actually looking at me saying, and I meet a colleague working for the HR, the human resources section at that time. And I can never thank her enough. She looks at me and she said, what is your skill? What can you do? Because she heard I was coming out of a convent, and she said, what can an ex-nun bring to you in HCR? And I remember my words were, you can place me in difficult and remote places. I will always hold fast. That was the only thing I knew how to do, actually. And I got a 3-month contract, and here I am 26 years later. Young, to Croatia. Mm-hmm. To Croatia on a front line, dealing with one of the most difficult caseloads we had at that moment, which was, here's the evacuation from the detention centers in Prijedor, Karaterm, Omarska, the most difficult. We, with the ICRC, the International Red Cross Committee, they would come to UNHCR Transit Center, skeletons. You remember those skeletons behind the barbed wires on the Time magazine in 1992, 1993? That was my first project.
and you saw them for yourself.
I lived with them. 60,000 people were resettled coming out of detention with family reunification and resettled to third country. Interesting, 26 years later, I'm in a similar context with the evacuations we are having from Libya to Niger.
So, Alessandra, there must be things, you know, you've seen hell on earth. You've seen
Rwanda.
You've seen Afghanistan. You've seen Bosnia.
Yes.
You've seen
Sri Lanka.
Horrific.
The tsunami in Indonesia.
Crimes against humanity.
Totally.
What makes you angry?
What makes me angry is, I quote a thought from our High Commissioner Grandi. He said, we are no longer capable to consolidate peace. We are no longer capable to make peace. Therefore, people are forced to flee. I am angry that we don't have leaders to devote or dedicate their time and their life to learn how to make peace. I mean, I am angry because there is not this. We have lost this capacity.
Even though you've seen all of this, been through all of this, and you're angry that there's so little peace, so many more people forced to flee, what is it that keeps you going?
What keeps me going is that if you discover in yourself that you have this call and you recognize that you have it, like a doctor, an ER, or a musician, or if I would have turned away my back to this call, that would have been a crime.
Against whom?
Against humanity, quite frankly, in the sense that if you discover that you have a call to live in the mist and to fight for human dignity, and you just turn the page or you zap with your, like for a TV channel.
The remote control.
And you remote and you change your channel. I would have been angry with myself. I probably wouldn't have been the person I am, no?
You're one of the most empathetic people I've ever met. How does that affect you working with refugees who have indeed lost everything, not just their homes, but also family members and community, jobs?
I think this is, the empathy is there, but there is at the same time, when I am in action, I think it's like a surgeon. There is something, I don't know how to explain it, I'll find it, that
you keep a
that
a certain
keep the
distance.
Distance, and I depersonalize. Then a few days later, when I am maybe sitting or relaxing, then of course I go through it with different feelings. But on the moment, I have to take decisions, I react, I have to guide a team.
Alessandra, these days, what keeps you awake at night?
What keeps me awake at night is this project that has started between Libya and Niger, these evacuations of persons of concern of UNHCR that have gone through detention and are still in detention. And what keeps me awake at night is, we need to get them all out, but do we have the means?
Is there anything from your past that keeps you awake at night?
I have to say that despite having gone through difficult situations at work, I have this incredible gift to be able to sleep really almost 8 hours full. But of course, during the day, something might remind me of something. And yes, I remember in 1993 in the Kuplensko refugee camp where a tent got on fire and a kid lost its life. There's many things, but there is this gift, and this is why I'm saying I'm fit probably for this job. There's this gift that allows me to take it, feel it, but allows me to carry on, I would say, also with a sense of serenity and joy.
Alessandra, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Thank you for talking to us on this podcast.
Thank you very much.
all the best wishes for your important work and stay safe.
Yes, I will. Thank you so very much. And sure, I will stay safe.
Thanks for listening to Awake at Night. Find out more about the series and see pictures and videos of Alessandra by visiting unhcr.org/awakeatnight. Find us on Facebook at UNHCR, and on Twitter we're at Refugees, and I'm at Melissa R. Fleming. You can also follow Alessandra on at UNHCR_Morelli. Thanks to Alex Court and the fantastic design and studio teams here at UNHCR, and to my producers, Bethany Bell, and also Laura Sheeter of Chalk and Blade. The original music for this podcast was written and performed by Nadine Shah and was produced by Ben Hillier. Nadine's latest incredible album, Holiday Destination, was inspired by the Syrian refugee crisis. This is the last interview in this series of Awake at Night. We'll be back with another season soon. Please share your thoughts with us using #AwakeAtNight and do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.